Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. This is Renee. I'm drinking a raging bitch. Probably should have been drinking another werewolf the night before Halloween, but there wasn't any cold. I have a case and there weren't any cold. So raging bitch it is. We're here with Lindsay Hunter, author of Don't Kiss Me. Lindsay, how are you doing and what are you drinking?
I'm doing great. I am in my pajamas. In my basement, and I am drinking Yellowtail Cabernet Sauvignon.
Ooh.
It's classy in Chicago.
Very nice.
And what are you celebrating with this evening, Jessica?
Oh, I'm doing the Blue Moon Harvest Pumpkin Ale tonight.
Ooh, yum.
Yeah. That's all I got.
That's all I got. I told you it was going to be weird. Listeners at home, you might notice that there's a voice missing tonight. And well, it's Dakota's not here tonight, and we'll talk about that a little bit more at the end of the show. Prepared for like awkward silences where we like he's supposed to be. So, Don't Kiss Me. I'm going to start off with like maybe the weirdest question I have, if that's okay. Hmm. Just get the weirdness out of the way. First thing. I love vulgar women. And I love that there's no shying away from bodily functions and swear words and, you know, all the uncomfortable stuff, all the vulgar stuff. It's right out there in your stories, but it doesn't come across as gratuitous or, yeah, I'm going to show those guys that I know how to swear. Like, it comes across really well, and I kind of looked at the reviews, and I expected somebody to be pissed off about it, because there's always somebody who's pissed off about someone who's straightforward with these kind of things. Nobody's pissed off, but everybody, just, you are a good enough writer that they don't care. So
I have seen a few people kind of be, I remember like one of the first Goodreads reviews that came out, one woman said, you know, she just says fart too much. I just hate that word. I just can't get this book. Someone else didn't like that I used the word jizz or something like that. So some people do take issue with it. But, yeah, it has been overwhelmingly like what you said. Like, you know, people aren't very perturbed by that, or they sort of embrace it. And that's like, I'm sorry that I interrupted your question, but that's what I strive for, is not to be gimmicky or not to be vulgar for vulgar sake. But I think in my own life, I can't, like, I hate hiding those things. I hate pretending like they're not there. So I just, you know, it's part of what makes us all human are these things. And I think if you as a writer and you as a human being can see past those, or, you know, sort of take those and as part of the whole, you know, you can really start to see the humanity in everyone, even these people that you might walk by because they're actively picking their nose, or, you know, they're trying to date a 9-year-old or something. But I think that's important to me in my real life, and very important to me in my writing life, is to show the humanity in sort of these, like, super real or hyper real situations.
I just knew that you were my people because I have like a project that I've since abandoned, but one time I was going through it, you know, marking up what, you know, say what was going to stay. And I realized that there's a lot of vomiting in that project. And so when I discover someone who understands the power of vomit, I feel like we connect on a really basic level.
No, I hear you. I used to fear, you know, like, it used to not be such a thing that you would see on TV or in movies or whatever, but now it's like in everything people are vomiting.
Yeah.
Like one of me and my husband's favorite shows is the Real World Road Rules Challenge on MTV, and like they puke everywhere in that show. And at first it used to really freak me out, the idea of someone upchucking for some reason, just like, it just seemed like a total loss of control and like just seems so animal. But I don't know. I think I got past that. I don't know if it was, I don't know what it was, but I'm not as freaked out by it as I once was.
What scared me, I think, with Vomit is Stand By Me. Isn't that the one where they tell a story and, like, everyone in the whole room pukes?
That's right, with the pie eating.
Yes. I was really young when I saw that, and I was like, oh, this is horrible. And every time there's a scene anywhere with vomiting, I somehow flash back to the pie eating scene.
I don't like seeing it. I don't like seeing it.
No one loves seeing it.
No one.
But
if you do, then there are places for you on the internet. You can find
in
them,
dark
but...
corners of the internet.
Yeah.
No, but I just.
I remember, like, when I was like 20 or something, I was listening to Howard Stern, and I was getting dressed for work. And do you guys ever listen to him, or did you ever listen to him? He used to have this guy that would come on named Beetlejuice, who I think was a dwarf, and he had all these other sorts of mental and health issues. But they would, like, send him out to, like, clubs and whatever to, like, be, you know, appear as Beetlejuice. And he got so drunk one time that he was, like, just, he could not stop vomiting, and they had audio of it. And it was the horrific thing I had ever heard. It was just over and over and over, this person, clearly who had alcohol poisoning, just, like, vomiting. I don't know. I that stuck with me for a long time.
The sound is, like, the worst part.
Yeah.
I feel like.
Yes.
Because no matter where, like, if I live in a small house, so if someone's vomiting in my house, I'm going to hear it.
Yeah.
So, you get, like, I feel like I can't escape it. That is, like you said, like, that's the part I think that makes it feel so animal, because it's just, like, sounds. Guttural, nasty, horrible sounds. Yeah.
Yes, I know, and I dread, I'm knocking on wood now because, you know, that's going to happen with my son one day. And I just actively dread it.
Yeah, my kid never spit up. She never was like, you know, she didn't drool a lot or any of that. So then the first time that she really vomited, she made up for that whole 2 years that she didn't spit up. And it was like, neither one of us knew what to do because we hadn't been, like, primed for it. I feel like that's what spit up is. It's like your introduction to what you will have to face eventually.
But it's so different. Spit up just sort of dribbles down. Vomit shoots out, especially with a kid. They're not aiming. They're just like, I feel like they just stand there and then the vomit just comes out like The Exorcist. Like, they're not like, let me get this in the toilet. They're like, I got to get this out.
There's a Henry Rollins bit he does about puking on the Trans-Siberian Express. And he's talking about when kids vomit, that it's the worst when they vomit because they're, like, narrating it and telling you how horrible it is as it happens. They're like, oh my God, it tastes like pizza and fascism.
I really am not looking forward to that.
I have finally, like, in the last year or so, I've trained my son to puke, like, in a bucket.
That's great. That's a good point.
He does really good now. I'm like, do you need your bucket? And at first he'll be like, no, because he's scared. Like, he's scared that he's going to throw up and he doesn't want it. But then he'll get it. And one time I had some friends over for dinner, and over the dinner table he looks at me and goes, I puke in my Easter bucket. And I'm like,
God.
He does. Like, he's not telling a lie. It is. It's an old Easter bucket. Yeah, he does.
I used to puke in my mom's silver mixing bowls, and it just dawned on me recently that those are the same mixing bowls that I used to cook for my family.
Oh, that's
great. Oh, God. We always have, like, we have the bathroom trash can gets emptied out, and, you know, a grocery bag gets put in it. That's what we use.
Oh, yeah, good call.
Yeah.
Because then nobody's going to get passed down something and be like, hey, I used to puke in that. I mean, that's
for my mom,
why,
it's like everything's reusable. Like, she tried to give me a cracked cake plate without a lid here. And I was like, lady, throw this away.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, oh, yeah, I could just throw it away.
No. Does she save tinfoil too? Used old tinfoil.
Oh,
she's not one of those. No, she's not one of those. And that's why I think she doesn't save, like, she keeps things, but she doesn't want to keep them forever. She wants them out of her life. But it's hard for her to, like, if they're things that she actively used, you know, over and over and over again, then it's hard for her to just throw them away. But no, not tinfoil or Ziplocs or anything like that.
That's good.
People who reuse Ziplocs, like, they weird me out.
Yeah, I know.
It's so much effort to go through. Just buy a Tupperware thing, right?
They're always filmy or wet.
No, that's... See,
my grandma used to, like, dry them out on her like, on her wooden spoons. And
she doesn't do the Ziplocs anymore, but, yeah, she'll keep basically everything else she can possibly get. I excuse it because she grew up in the Depression, you know? So I think,
yeah.
Oh, well,
she has a mindset.
Like, she has to keep it, but, oh, man, it used to drive me crazy. We had to have a whole entire drawer full of tinfoil that was crumpled up and useless. Every Christmas, she would want to move the paper.
Tinfoil twice, like, in a way that serves a purpose.
yes, exactly. Did you ever watch that show, Hoarders?
Oh,
yes.
God. You know what? I used to watch it every now and then. Like, it's on, and sometimes it motivates me to clean my house, and sometimes it makes me feel like, hey, I'm not doing so bad. But then there was one that, like, traumatized me. Like, I mean, I turned the TV off, I went outside, and I called my mom, because I was just like, I can't. They found a dead cat under some stuff, and there was so much stuff on this dead cat, and it had been there for so long that it was flattened, like in a Looney Tunes, like a steamroller. Yeah, and I was, that was it.
My Lord.
No more Hoarders for me.
I was just going to talk about the one where the lady was sitting, and she only had one spot in the kitchen where she could sit, and so she slept sitting up in a chair because that's the only spot she had. And she would just rip off her adult diapers and throw them behind her and put in a new one. So behind her chair, she had a, like, dune of diapers, like, almost to the ceiling, dirty diapers.
I think that's worse than the cat, honestly.
Is that
because
the same one with the cat? Oh, it's worse than the cat.
They didn't know the cat was there. They didn't know that. They weren't actively, like, let's just keep this dead cat. But she made the decision to have Mount adult diaper, like, right there behind her.
Mm. Yeah, so people had to come in with, like, hazmat suits, like, to clean it out because, you know, it was so filled with germs and ugh.
That is, oh, God.
Good order.
God.
I think I'd rather be, like, a crime scene cleanup person than the people who clean out hoarders' houses.
I know.
Probably,
in a way, it's almost, well, I don't know. I was going to say in a way it's less sad, but that's a terrible thing to say. It's all sad.
But it is, it's less sad. And also, you kind of know what to expect. You're like, there's going to be, like, some gore. There might be a little bit of poop. But that's it. That's all there is, and it's fine. There's no surprise at a crime scene. The detectives and police have already taken care of being surprised. You'd go in and clean up.
That's true. And the bodies have probably been removed, so you don't have to look at that.
Exactly.
Yep.
It's just one specific horrific thing that you have to deal with, not surprise layers of it.
Ooh. Like, oh, God, there's a cat.
Super fun.
I think it's a cat. I'm really disturbed now because I talked about it. I mean, I turned the TV off and I never watched Hoarders ever again after that.
I think that might have been a weekend.
Not watching cable.
What's that?
I think that might have been the beginning of me not watching cable. Like, I just...
Oh, interesting.
Because, you know, like, Hoarders is that one of those shows that you watch because the TV on, it was on.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure there are people that are like, ooh, can't wait to watch Hoarders. I'm going to set the DVR in case I get home late, but...
Oh, God. Yeah, our friend had told us, gotta watch Hoarders, you gotta watch Hoarders. So, like, for one weekend, we sat with our friend and watched, like, 3 or 4 episodes. And by the end of those, we were like, we can't, all of us were like, no more. No, it's too much.
So, I actually can tie this in, I swear I can. Because you have a story called You and Your Cats.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Yes.
A woman that lives alone at home.
That was fucking beautiful, and Jessica.
I figured it out. Yeah, I
wasn't did sure. It.
I win podcast award now. I don't know what that award is.
Yes.
So did that come from hoarders? Is that what inspired you to write that? Or was it something completely different?
I'm sure part of it did. I mean, I wanted to write a story about, like, someone who becomes a cat lady. And then in classic form, I can't just write about it in terms of, like, oh, she has three or four cats and she's a cat lady. It has to become, like, she has a real problem. She's, like, basically becoming a cat. I think, I'm sure watching Hoarders helped me get to that place of someone hoarding cats and hoarding kitty litter, as she does. I was just fascinated with, like, in every story, I'm fascinated with sort of the loneliness that makes these people do what they do, or, like, you know, they embrace their loneliness or they try to reject, you know, deny their loneliness. And she had just been left by her boyfriend and was, you know, looking for companionship, and it wasn't filling the hole, it wasn't filling the hole, it wasn't filling the hole. And then she had a house full of cats and Dune kitty litter.
Which happens to everyone every now
yes.
and then. We've all been there.
Right. That's right.
But for the record, I have two cats. I haven't actually been there.
No, I love cats. My mom, actually, my mom and I lived with my mom for a summer, like, in between my sophomore and junior year of college or something. And we found a cat, so we rescued it, and then we adopted another cat. And so we had these cats, Buster and Petey, for like 6 months. And I had moved out of my mom's house, like, when the fall semester started, and she kept the cats at her house. Christmas Day, I went over, you know, my whole family was at my mom's condo for Christmas. There's a knock on the door, and my mom comes out of the back bedroom with Buster in a pillowcase, opens the door, and she's like, here you go. These people, she had put an ad in the paper, free cat, and these people came to get it as a Christmas present, came to get Buster as a Christmas present for their grandmother. And the next day, someone else came to get Petey, and my mom said, I just didn't want to become a cat lady.
Oh.
Gave the cats away.
Just like, get them away. Get them out.
Yes, she loved those cats. She loved those cats. Like, she loved them, and I loved them, and she was just like, she was single at the time. She was like, I didn't want to be a cat lady.
I mean, sometimes you have
horrible.
To, yeah. Sometimes you just have to say to yourself, is this where I wanted to be at this age when I imagined
yeah.
it
yeah.
5 years ago? And if you're seeing signs of something bigger, maybe you get rid of your cats. I don't know.
Like cat ladyism, yes.
That's great. No,
I don't recommend that for anyone, because I think if you make a commitment to an animal, you need to follow through. But that's
well, I agree. Yeah. I guess my joke was heartless.
You're a cruel woman, but yeah.
I wouldn't get rid of my cats, but I only have two, and I'm not currently single, so I can keep the cats. It's fine. you have something
to do? Yeah, I wanted to squeeze in real quick. We had a listener question from Rebecca Jones Howe, and I really loved this one. She said, Do you ever feel like your flash tales would pack as much punch if they were extended into longer short stories? Because I know a lot of what you're doing is you've got some flash stories and very short things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worry about that a lot. I have, like, in Daddy's, there's a longer one called The Fence. You know, I have a few here and there. But, no, it's totally something that I worry about. And I'm writing a novel right now that's coming out next fall. And, you know, that punch, that, like, freshness, that, like, shock, you know, like, that stuff is, you know, that newness, that stuff is
yeah.
the most important thing to me in terms of, like, when I'm writing and when people are reading. So trying to preserve that over a longer piece is a difficult thing. It's a new challenge because I'm used to writing my stories all in one piece. If I sit down, I write it, it's done. With a novel, you can't do that. With a longer piece, you can't do that. And so it's daunting. It's like, you know, can I maintain this? Can I, are people going to be still interested? And do they want to read like this for 60,000 words? You know, like, do they need a break? Like, you know, so I worry about that a lot. And when writing my novel, I was worried about that a lot. But but hopefully there's still something there for everyone.
Yeah.
But I think if you're maintaining, you know, if you're staying true to the voice of whatever you're working on, even if it's not in first person, if it's in third person or whatever, if you're staying true to that voice and, you know, making sure that that's, you know, maintained throughout, I think you'll be okay. But, Rebecca, I do worry about that a lot.
I'm going to follow up with a question about, I guess, like the difference between flash short stories and like a novel length work. Because I sort of see those three things as completely different types of art. You know, with flash, it really is more about a feeling because you're not going to get every detail into flash. And if you tried to do that, it would read like a list. You know, that's not what flash is for. And then with a short story, you have to like combine more detail while maintaining that one feeling that you want somebody to walk away with. And then with a novel, you're going to be a lot of different emotions, a lot of different themes, a lot of different, you know, there's definitely more characters and everything else. So do you feel like it's different when you're sitting down, you're writing one of these flash stories, you're writing a novel? Do you feel like it's all the same process, or do you feel like there's difference too?
No, I think you're right. I think there's definitely, I think you're absolutely right. It's, you know, it's totally different. I think there's opportunity to show an entire world in a flash piece, just as you would in a short story or in a novel. Even if you're only seeing a glimpse of that world or you know, flash pieces can span 30 seconds, they can span years, just as
right.
a short story or a novel could. But in terms of how I'm writing it, in order to keep my excitement, my interest in my process that I value as I was writing the novel, which I feel like is what I can give people, I gave myself a word count. Very much like I would have, you know, very much the same amount of words that a flash fiction piece would be. So every day I would sit down and I would have to write 2,500 words. And that was basically a chapter. So all my chapters are like 2,000 to 2,500 words. And it's each chapter is from the point of view of one of five characters. So for me, it was similar to writing flash fiction because I could go into different characters' minds. I could tell their little piece of the story right then. Then I could jump to someone else and tell their little piece of the story. And I was giving myself flash fiction-y word count goals. Because that was
yeah.
the only really way that I knew how to write a novel. And if I, you know, I gave myself a lot of shit about, do I even want to write a novel? Like, I don't even need to write a novel if I don't want to. But I did want to. I do want to. So that was the only way I could think of to get into it and to maintain my own level of interest, quite frankly, as I was writing. So I think you're right. I think, you know, reading a flash fiction collection is very different from reading a short story collection is very different from reading a novel, as it is all different writing those things. But I have to do certain things to keep my engagement going.
I just think that's really interesting because, and I'm sure I'm positive I'm not alone. I don't outline when I write anything, no matter how long or short it is. But I had this really bad habit of starting things that I thought were going to be novels that just kind of got weird at some point. And not in
yeah,
a good way.
Totally.
Not in an interesting way. They just, it was sort
yeah.
of like, I don't even know what this is. But the last project, I finished the draft. It's still in progress. I approached it like you were saying. I told myself that each chapter would be between 2,500 and 3,000 words, and I was going to make each chapter have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I finished that one. So,
yeah, see, there you go. You have to do it the way that you would do it. Like, I always think about, I saw Linda Barry give a talk at my alma mater, the Art Institute, a year or two ago, and she was talking about writing Cruddy, which is one of my favorite books, and she kept saying to herself, okay, well, man, you know, this is really hard. Well, how would I write it? How would I write it? And then she finally realized, wait a minute, I am writing it. And she thought, well, I would paint it first. So she painted Cruddy first, and then she went back and wrote it. And it's like you have to do it the way that you would do it. You know, like you see how other people do it, and you think, well, that's the way it's done. I have to do it that way. And then you just get bored, or it turns into something, you know, with a dead end, or it turns weird, or you're just not interested anymore. And that's because you have to do it the way that you would do it. And I think that that's what will, you know, hold value to any reader. And you know, like if you're sending it out into the world, it has to be something that you love and that you loved making and that you believe in. So I'm a firm believer in like, all right, well, how would I do it? Okay, I would do it this way. Well, I'm going to do it that way.
Yeah, I think that's great. I'm going to follow that up with my favorite listener question.
Oh.
And it's from a listener who said he didn't have a question. he says, I have no questions at the moment other than, what the fuck is wrong with you and how can I do it too?
Who is this person?
Nick Corpin.
Nick Corpin.
Friend of the show.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, Nick. I don't think there's anything wrong with me, Nick. What the fuck is wrong with you? I mean, I've talked about this before. I think I spent a lot of time trying to write, like, you know, I just was talking about this, trying to write what I thought I should be writing or what I thought people wanted to read or what was sort of established, you know, like things that we were studying in school. I tried to write like that. And I had this professor, Matthew Gulish, who was like, you know, if you're having fun writing something, you should pay attention to that because you should be having fun. Like there's this popular myth that you, as a writer, should be sort of pained, you know, and miserable, but you're doing it because you have to. And he was like, you know, that's kind of bullshit. Like if you're having fun, people will have fun as they're experiencing it or reading it or whatever. So that helped me a lot. And just the whole process of like in grad school, like trying and failing and trying and failing and never really liking or owning what I was writing. And then finally just sort of sitting down and like Linda Barry, well, how would I do it? And just sort of vomiting on the page. speaking of vomit, and then really liking it and really thinking like, wow, man, this is mine. This doesn't sound like anyone else. I feel proud of this. I want to, like, I remember one of the first times that happened, I wrote the first story in my first question, my brother, and kind of based on my brother, and I called him immediately. It was like 7 a.m. I was like, you have to listen to this, listen to what I read. And he was like, okay. But I was so proud of it and so excited that I just, ever since then, I've just been, you know, trying to stay true to that and writing it the way that I would want to write it. So I don't know what's wrong with me. Nick, my father has sort of asked me the same thing. Why can't I just write stories about happy puppies or clowns coming out of a car? And I told him you wouldn't want to read those stories that I would write because they would turn
bad. They would turn very bad, yeah.
but I think, Nick, you're already doing it, so shoulda.
I know. He acts like he's not a great writer, right? He like, oh, I'm a terrible writer.
Yeah. That's good, though, man. Stay humble. You know, like that means you're just going to always work hard.
There you go.
Well, one thing Nick mentioned was that he saw you read a couple of times, and I did want to mention you have done some live readings. You have a live reading coming up next month, right?
Yes. And I have two. I have one in Philadelphia at Tire Fire Reading Series, which I'm really excited about, and then I have one at the Franklin Park Reading Series in Brooklyn, which I'm also thrilled about.
How do you approach, like, do you plan in advance what story you're going to read, or do you have a few that you wait to see what you're going to do, or what's your approach when you're doing a live reading?
Yeah, so since I've been reading for this book, I bring my book with me, and then I just kind of survey the crowd and sort of feel the vibe, and then I think, all right, well, I feel like reading this, or I feel like reading that. When I'm not, you know, reading for the book, I bring a couple options, like 2 or 3 options. And I do the same thing. I never think, because I never know. Like, I never know how I'm going to feel right before. I never know how the crowd is going to seem or, you know, like, I want to keep my decision I don't make my decision till right up until the very end. I just read in Austin at the book fest, I made my decision on stage. I got up on stage and I was like, I think I'll read this. I decide pretty soon before I read.
Now, and this, we might just edit this out if I'm completely wrong, but have you read / are you going to be reading with Scott McClanahan?
Yes, I am at the Franklin Park Reading Series.
Did you know that the reason why we had to flip your episode around is because of Scott?
That motherfucker.
Exactly. That's
what
I found that
piece
out
of shit. I'm just kidding. I love
him.
Oh
my god. We are everywhere.
We do too. He let me know, well, the day before I asked you, he said, you know, I can't do this, whatever nonsense.
Like,
reason.
He can't do it at all, or he couldn't do it today?
No, he couldn't do it today. He's going to flip-flop.
Oh.
He's going to do what was originally November 13th, knock on wood, he should be here. But so I got everything straightened out, got you straightened out, got him straightened out, got Renee straightened out, everything's good. And then today he messaged me. He's like, actually, I could probably do it late tonight if you wanted. And I kind of wanted to choke my computer a little. I was like, shut up. But I was like, no, it's fine. It's fine. We'll just do it.
Have you guys ever seen him read before?
I've seen video. Not live.
We've had him on the show before.
Yeah,
oh, okay,
he's
okay.
On before.
And it's like, it's kind of a famous show because we didn't know anything about Scott before he was on the show, aside from reading Short Story Collection.
We had no idea how badly he was going to fuck with us, is what it's going to be. And he truly
That's great.
I love
he's
that
coming
he's
on
back
for a repeat because,
anything.
Yeah, we, I was like, we have to try this again.
We're ready this time.
Oh, man. That's fantastic. I know. I'm nervous. I'm really nervous. Like, I don't desire to read with him because he is just captivating and he will blow everyone's dick off. So I'm nervous about that.
That's the best. He should have you blurb his next book because that's the best blurb.
Yes, Scott.
You're going to blow everybody's dicks off. I mean, it's scary, but it's exciting, right?
But I saw that little that you were doing upcoming reading with him. I thought, oh man, this is one of those weird cosmic things that's happening right now.
I've read with him. Okay. I've read with him a couple times before. But Panina, who runs the Franklin Park Reading Series, was like, "Oh, I think you'd be good to read with Scott." And I was like, "I think I agree with you." And then I was like, "What am I saying? No one should read with Scott."
Sure. Yeah.
So I'm gonna do the worst segue ever.
Oh, okay.
Just jump into
you
something
will not
else.
Win the award.
I will not win the award. Well, see, I had a segue, and then I realized that the question wouldn't work with it. Anyway. Okay. One of the things that I thought was interesting is that all of these stories, there's a theme. There is a common thread between all of these stories. But you didn't make it like these are all stories about people who work in an office and hate their jobs or whatever. You have almost all of these are told from a woman's perspective, first of all, which I think is cool. But then you have a story that's kind of domestic fiction. It's about a mom and she's doing her thing. And then you have a story about Richard Nixon. And then you have a story where it's just happened. And I have to say, I think it's really cool. I was wondering, when you decided to put a collection together, what was your thinking? What did you just have these stories and go, you know what, I'm going to toss them together because I think that I can see a thread between the characters? Or did you go into it saying, I'm going to write stories that fit into this theme of sort of desperation and sadness and loneliness.
Well, with both my collections, I wasn't planning. I didn't have any grand plan as I was writing the stories. So I was writing stories as I was, you know, going to be reading them out at certain places or because I had ideas. And then with my first collection, this publisher in Chicago, Featherproofs, who's a great, great publisher, said, write us a book. And I just kept thinking they were being polite. And then finally they were like, no, really, write us a book. And I was like, well, I have all these stories. Let's do it. So we kind of just put together the stories that seemed worthy at that point into Daddies, which is my first collection. And then after that, there was a lot of I feel like an asshole when I say there was a lot of interest from publishers. But, you know, I had some interest from publishers and agents. But they kept asking me for a novel. And so I was like, shit, you know, like that was my whole, like, you know, if I want to write a novel, I have to write a novel. I don't have to write a novel. Should I write a novel? So that was my whole. And then in the middle of doing all that and starting novels and abandoning them, I was writing stories. And at the beginning of last year, at the beginning of 2012, I was like, shit, I think I have another collection of stories. Let me put them together because that'll make me feel like I've done something with my life, you know, in this past 2 years. And I did, and I sent it to, so there wasn't any grand plan. There wasn't any like, ooh, you know, let me make these connect. It was just like, I have these stories. There is a common theme of people, you know, yearning or being really horny or desperate or whatever, or weird. So that's how I put that together. Neither of them had any sort of like, yeah, let's, you know, architect this in a certain way, which is also an asshole thing of me to say, but it's true.
I don't think it's an asshole thing to say that you had interest from publishers. It just makes me jealous. And that makes me an asshole. So, God, I lost my train of thought. Okay.
Oh.
No. Okay. So I wanted to know, I guess, because you talk about, like, you mentioned a couple times the, like, deciding to write a novel and it, like, sort of being ambivalent about it. What is it that pushed you over the edge and you said, okay, not only can I do this, but I want to do this?
Before I even started going to grad school, I was writing a novel in longhand because I was a writer, man. And then in grad school, I was working on the same novel, and it was terrible. It was basically the same scene over and over and over again. And every chapter was like in a different tone and voice. Like, it was just awful, and I was kind of learning, you know, what not to do and what I didn't like to do. But I always wanted to write a novel. Like, I always did. It's mainly what I read are novels, which might be surprising, but so I think that's what it was. At the end of the day, I was like, I just really want to see if I can do it. I just really, I want at least to try it. So thankfully someone bought it. and someone will read it. Probably not my mom or dad, but someone, maybe my husband.
I can't remember who it was. Was it Tom Fitz that said that his dad told him he read his novel to his mom in the hospital, but he edited out all the bad words? Or was that somebody else?
I don't know. Do you remember that even?
Maybe somebody I was talking to, and I'm just assuming that I don't talk to anybody interesting except for on the show. Was telling me that they were like, yeah, I read your book to mom and she really liked it. And he was like kind of horrified. And he's like, what? I changed all the bad words.
Oh.
Wow, so, that's dedication.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I remember my mom like admitting to me, I think she thought I was going to be really upset that the only story of mine she'd ever read was one that I like actually, like I put it in her lap and said, read this. And I was like, no, that's probably good.
My mom, I was surprised. My mom read Daddies and was like, you need help. I'm worried about you. You need therapy or whatever. But then she read Don't Kiss Me and she was like, oh, I get it. This is fiction. You're a writer. You're funny. I get it. It was like wonderful. It was wonderful for her to have that breakthrough because now she doesn't worry so much about me.
Right.
But yeah, she's read them all. I was surprised. I, you know, like it's so weird to read your family stuff, you know? Like my mom is also a writer and she'll have me read her stuff every once in a while. And it's good, but it's still like, oh, it's my mom. And I know she's like, oh, this is my daughter, you know? So it's
yeah.
so hard.
Well, we wanted to plug, we know you have a short story coming out. Wait, is it
yeah,
next,
I'm
okay,
stuck.
Next year in a, I got completely lost.
Anthology?
Neo-noir anthology called The New Black.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
That's the only one we want to plug, because that one's edited by Richard Thomas, and he's a
yes.
friend of the show. He's been on.
He's
so,
one of our very first guests. He took a chance on it.
He does. He takes
like
chances on
two
people.
Or three. So...
Yeah, he's actually hit me up for two stories, for two anthologies.
Oh.
He's awesome.
Whoa.
He's a very great supporter. What?
I didn't know that there were two anthologies, but then I didn't want to say that because what if Richard listens and I feel like I should have known that there were two, and so now I feel awkward.
Like he's so prolific and so involved and just always doing stuff. So yeah, he's been awesome.
That's very
and
exciting.
There's another anthology that I have a story in called Black Candies. That's for sale now, actually. It's a story
oh,
I
okay.
wrote about John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy played it, dressed up as a clown, but when he was a clown, he called himself Pogo. So the story's
uh-huh.
called I'm Pogo, and it's in
Ooh.
Black Candies. So I want to plug that, too, because that's for sale now.
Yeah.
I don't
well,
know
we'll
if I
up.
Love it or hate it about myself that I heard you say, I have a story about John Wayne Gacy, and I gasped with, like, delight. Like, oh,
I know, I know. When I was writing it, I was doing a lot of research into him, and there's actually, like, YouTube interviews with him. And
oh.
and I was doing it all in the very wee hours of the morning before work, so it was still dark outside, and I started to worry about myself. I was like, this is fucked up. Why am I doing this? This person brutally murdered 33 kids, you know? Ugh.
But, you know,
I'm sick inside, but I just love that series.
I know, me too. I don't know what it is. I don't know
yeah.
what it is. I saw his brain there at the Encyclopedia Show, which is a reading series in Chicago. I read that story. It was about the theme of the show was serial killers. And they had a doctor who, what's her name, is Clarice Darling is based on. In Silence of the Lambs, she's based
oh,
on
yeah.
her. She came in. She's a famous serial killer profiler, not profiler, interviewer. And she is the one who performed the autopsy on John Wayne Gacy, and she has his brain.
She
and
has
the thought
brain.
Was she brought his brain in a Ziploc. Like, she brought slivers, like slices of his brain in, like there were slices of bread
don't
in a
they
Ziploc
need to
bag.
Be preserved specially or something? Like, you don't
I guess. I guess. Well, the thought was he had fallen. He had fallen off the swing sets when he was a kid, and the thought was, well, he had a serious brain injury or some sort of brain injury, and that's why he did all these things. And she said
oh
his brain was perfectly healthy.
Oh,
good. Because I was going to get scared because I totally fell off the swing set when I was a kid. And
well, do you dress like a clown and kill people? I mean,
I know, yeah.
But I
is
good.
Yeah.
I
know about you, but
wasn't he? I feel like he was. I think he was. But when Ross Lockhart was on the show, he edited an anthology about Jack the Ripper, and I was saying how it is kind of weird that, I mean, there is a fascination with serial killers. I think everybody has it to a certain extent. That's why a show like Dexter could be successful.
Yeah,
and then it
totally.
Gets weird people that, like, they're not just interested, but they're, like, obsessive. Like, the people, they call themselves Ted Heads, and they're, like, super into Ted Bundy.
Oh.
He's super sexy, and it's like, no, don't, because the fact that he was good is what he used to kill people.
Well,
yes,
well
exactly.
yeah, that's the thing.
It's actually a negative attribute in this case, I think.
Well, yeah, like John Wayne Gacy, where he did all that was in Chicago. So, like, it was on Sunnyside, and I remember thinking, like, oh, I could just drive. They tore that house down, I believe. They razed it and maybe built something else on top of it, but I remember thinking, like, oh, I could just drive right. And it's like, why would I want to drive by that? What is wrong with me? But it's that morbid fascination. And I love all those, like, 48 Hours mystery shows,
yes.
you know, like Dateline. I love those shows. And it's like, why? These are really sad. Like, people lost loved ones in horrible ways.
When that I want to call it new, but it's probably, I don't even know how many years old now, but the movie Zodiac with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh,
and
I love that movie. I love that movie.
You were my people.
Yes. I haven't.
Oh, my gosh. I could watch the beginning scene where the two teenagers, like, get in the car and they drive to the lookout, and I think they're listening to Hurdy-Gurdy Man at that point, and
mm-hmm.
just that the killer quietly comes up. And just, oh, my gosh. I don't know why, but that part is maybe
what
the most, like, intense, horrific, beautiful sequence. What?
That movie's practically about nothing. Like,
it's not. It's about
the way. Like, if you lay it out, it could almost be boring, but I'm riveted for the entire 9 million hours
it's
that
so
it goes on.
It's so perfectly done. And I know it's super long.
It is.
But I just think it's so perfectly done. It's,
you
like, nostalgic
look,
in all the right
it.
Ways.
But you get to
yeah,
look at Jake Gyllenhaal and Robert Downey Jr. for the duration of the film, so I think that takes a little bit of the pressure off.
Either
yeah.
way, though, that it's just so exciting. To
the part with Ione Skye where her tire blows out or whatever, and then she gets in the car with him, and he's
yeah.
like, I'm going to kill you, or something like that,
I
and she ends up out with her baby, horrifying.
Yes, that is really scary. Like, I want to get a little teared up when that happens.
That's why I love David Fincher. He's best.
So, but I feel like Zodiac is interesting for the same reason that Summer of Sam is interesting. Did you guys see that movie?
Oh,
it
yeah.
was.
I don't think I ever
Spike
saw Summer of Sam.
Actually,
oh, okay.
I just,
well,
it was on
with Adrian Brody.
And I watched part of it.
Adrian Brody. He plays like this New Yorker who got like into British punk and has like a fake British accent. And but the reason why that movie is good, and it's the same reason that Zodiac is good, is because it's not really about the serial killer. It's what the serial killer did to people that were not his victims and how he affected, like, the world around him. So Zodiac is about how it affected this journalist and this cop. And Summer of Sam is about how it affected the entire city of New York. And it's so cool because it's, like, the backdrop that Spike Lee presents it against is like the death of disco and the rise of punk. But then you've also got all these random characters going through really weird shit that in some ways isn't even related, but they're relating with, like, people get like super paranoid. So, like, the guy used to be a Guido, but now he's a punk rocker. Like, maybe he's the killer because he's fucking weird. And, like, women going and getting their hair dyed so that they wouldn't be brunette because he only killed brunettes. Like, weird, just crazy stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's what interests me, maybe even more so than the serial killer thing, is, like, the way that those crimes, ripple out. The effects go so much further than what you would see on the surface.
Yes, totally.
We're running out of time because we were scrambling
killer,
for questions, and then we didn't get like half the listener questions in and like half of our own questions in. This is super fun.
Who knew?
Yeah. So
we were going to be talking about serial killers, though. So
we're going to spend 15 minutes on vomit and serial killers. I didn't know that.
That's my kind of podcast.
Yeah.
So. Because we, I feel like I should jump, like, try and squeeze his question in at the end.
Sure.
But keep in mind that you have to answer quickly.
Oh, God.
Okay, got it.
So this is a multi-layered question. Maybe you will not be able to answer it quickly. How much time have you spent in the South? Did your childhood shape your current writing voice and subject matter? And are your stories based on real-life events or people you knew or know? Now that you have a child, do you think your writing will change at all? And he says he's thinking of that story, that baby.
Yeah. Well, who is this?
This is Richard Thomas.
Oh, Richard. Yeah, that baby is one of the stories in the anthology.
Okay.
He loves that story. Yeah, I was worried about that. I'm just going to answer the child question. I spent from when I was 6 years old till when I was 25 years old in Central Florida. So that's how long I was down there. Although Central Florida is like the South, but not the South. It's like a weird, it's the South in some places, and then it's weird, like, not South in other places. So that's that. Yes, my childhood heavily influenced what I write. Is my stuff based on real life? I think in some senses it is. But it's not autobiographical in any way. It's like maybe based on this weird thing that happened or whatever, but no, it's not. You shouldn't read my stuff and think, wow, you know, what a terrible life she led. Yeah,
yeah,
because it's I had a fine childhood, a fine life. And then the final question, oh, am I worried that my writing will change after the birth of my son? I was definitely worried about that. Like, in all aspects of my life, like, I remember people telling me, like, oh, you're not going to care about your dog once your son comes along. You're just not going to care. And that I was horrified by because my dog is like my baby. And thankfully that hasn't been true, and I've still been writing the way that I always write, I think. Since my son has been born, he hasn't really robbed me of that kind of he hasn't robbed me of the desire to write. He hasn't robbed me of what of this of writing what I would want to write. He's you know, having a child is like a bomb going off in your life. It changes many,
yeah.
many things.
It's the best,
a lot of things
for
the better,
ever.
And some things you're like, fuck, what?
I think that's the best analogy ever.
It is. It's like kaboom. You're expect like, of course, like as you're pregnant, you're like, well, I know it's gonna be like a smoke bomb or something, and then it happens, and you're like, no, this is a fucking grenade. But it's wonderful. Like I look at him, and I cannot believe how much I love him. But no, I don't think that he's changed what I would write or how I would write or, you know, no, he hasn't.
Okay.
He's not allowed to read my books. But yeah, it changed what I'll write.
Yeah, you know, that is, I gotta admit, I'm more worried about, like, when my kid says, like, so what do you write? Then I'm worried
yeah.
about my mom reading it. Because it's like Robert Rodriguez made the Spy Kids movies because his kids were always asking him about what he did for a living.
Really?
And he couldn't. He was like, I stuff that you're not allowed to watch. That's what I do for a living. Things that you're not allowed to experience. So I think that's maybe someday I'm going to have to write, like, a kid's book. This is what I do.
I have one that's kind of started that was inspired by my nephews, and I always say, like, okay, I'll go back to that, I'll go back to that, I'll go back to that. So maybe I will one day. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to say to him.
I get a lot of
like,
shit.
I don't care.
I get a lot of shit for not writing or believing in happy endings in fiction, so I don't know. If anybody wants me to write a child's book, and then everybody dies.
Oh no!
Although, let me say, like I read the Golden Compass books like a couple years ago, and I was shocked at how violent and terrifying they were. And those are for kids. Those are for like, you know, like 8-year olds. You know,
yeah.
And like terrible shit is happening in them. So
I don't always rely on violence unless you account like actively trying to ruin your mood and make you very sad.
Yeah.
Like a mental violence. I just want you to be sad.
Yeah.
Why won't you cry? So we have like a minute left, and we
okay.
have one thing we really need to cover. As I said at the beginning of the show, Dakota is not here today, and you know, we've been doing the show for like a year and a half, and it started because Dakota said he wanted to do a podcast. And I said, oh, my God, me too. And Jessica said, am I invited? And
can I do it too? Yeah.
Yeah. So 2 weeks later, we're doing the podcast. Dakota is really busy, and he's got a lot of stuff going on. So he is on an indefinite hiatus. We hope he'll be back.
From us.
We will be back. He knows he is welcome back at any time. And, yeah, I just feel like this episode was weird because, like, there have been times where he's missed an episode, but there have never been times where we knew he wouldn't be here or that he wasn't going to be back next week. So it's kind of emotional, but it's not that big of a deal because he's coming back sometime.
Right.
Sometime he'll be back when things slow down for him. So, you know, in another very nostalgic mushy moment, I also feel like I have to acknowledge like the people who have actually been listening to us for that entire year and a half and hope that it wasn't just because Dakota asked really awkward questions and that they actually liked us too. Me and Jessica, we're all right.
We're okay.
But that is the end of the show. Lindsay, thank you so much for coming on. This was so much fun.
Thank you for having me.
This has been great. Thank you so much for stepping in for us, too.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. You changed the schedule for us, and you came on, and we got to talk about vomit, serial killers, and violence, and everything. All my favorite things.
Perfect.
So we're going to listen to a song like we always do. We'll be back next week, and because we changed the calendar, I have no idea who's on next week. Who's on next week, Jessica? Pavarti?
Pavarti Tyler.
Ah,
I hope I'm pronouncing that right because I haven't heard it out loud. But yeah.
I hope so, too. And that was that's a connection through Jessica McHugh, who in our pre-show meeting I was just saying how much I loved her and how glad I was to know her. So, yeah, we'll play a song, finish a drink, come back next week. More great stuff. Make sure you click all the links, and we're going to link up everything we talked about. And if you haven't read Lindsay's stuff, then the first two links are going to be, they're going to look like little pictures of her books, and you click buy them and you can read them. It's pretty amazing.
Yes, please.
So yeah, that's the show.